Well, international taxation does not mean that we know anything about international taxation. As a matter of fact, we know almost nothing. We know U.S. taxation, and even that sort of marginally. International taxation really deals with how the United States taxes international transactions, not how other countries tax it. Right? So when we're talking about international taxation, we really are talking about U.S. taxation. So the title, the name of this area of the law is a little bit misleading. So how does the United States tax transactions, business transactions, that have some sort of an international flavor to them? Well, for our purposes today, there are two types, two very distinct types of internationally flavored transactions. They are the so-called outbound and inbound transactions. And Bob touched upon that very briefly earlier today. So again, one more time, outbound transactions are those where a U.S.-based business or a U.S.-based person goes overseas to transact business, to enter into some sort of a business transaction, to invest, to, you know, to do whatever, right? So a U.S. person going overseas is an outbound transaction. And a foreigner coming into the United States, again, to invest or to do business, is an inbound transaction. So out of the U.S. into the U.S. Two very different areas of the law, really with no overlap almost, maybe no overlap at all. But conceptually, they're sort of based on the same premise, or the same concern, I should say. And the concern is the following. And it's really this concern that makes this area of tax law so incredibly complex. The concern is the following. Once an asset is outside of the United States, be it cash or a capital asset of some nature, once the asset is outside of the United States, the United States may lose its jurisdictional ability to tax that asset, may lose its legal ability to tax that asset, and probably just as importantly, it will often lose the practical ability to tax that asset or to collect on the tax assessment against such an asset. Right? So if you are a foreigner doing business in the United States and you, for example, generate $100 of profit in the United States, and then you simply take those $100 and take them back to, let's say, China, and the United States then decides, well, we should, you know, we should really have taxed this $100. Hey, you owe us $30. Well, how legally and practically can they now reach this person now that the money has left the United States and the person has left the United States? It's just not possible. So both inbound and outbound taxation sort of are designed to address this concern. You know, what can the United States do today while it has the legal authority to tax earnings and has the legal authority to collect against assets and the practical ability to actually reach something or someone? So let's deal with outbound taxation first. So we have an American business or an American person who is going to go overseas to do what? To start a business, let's say. Okay? So we have an American going overseas to start a business. What are the U.S. tax consequences of that? Well, here the answer is that it depends. What does it depend on? It depends on how our client, our U.S. person, is going to structure his offshore business. If the U.S. person simply goes to a foreign country, let's say he goes to Belgium, and he is going to be making waffles, going to have one of those little waffle stands on the streets there in Brussels, going to make waffles and sell them. If he's simply starting that business in his own name as a sole proprietor, then whatever profits he generates in Belgium will be taxable in the United States. Right? The United States is one, I would say, of a few, one of the few developed countries in the world that taxes based on worldwide income. So it doesn't matter where a U.S. taxpayer generates income. Right? Whatever in the world the income is generated can be made, the money can be made on the moon. It doesn't matter. If you're a U.S. taxpayer, you are taxed by the United States on your income overseas. So sole proprietorship, fairly simple. Whatever money you make, the United States will tax you on that money. Now, there are tax treaties that we have with certain countries that will dictate, can Belgium tax that income? Can the United States tax that income? Can both countries tax that income? Will then a foreign tax credit be available to offset the U.S. tax? So those are sort of secondary issues. But primarily, the United States will tax any monies you generate overseas. What if our client, instead of operating this waffle stand by himself, is going to set up a joint venture with a local partner? You know, he has a Belgian buddy in Brussels, and together they will own and operate this waffle stand. They're going to make some money. Well, now what we have for legal purposes and for tax purposes is a partnership. Right? So it's now the partnership that is making money, that is generating profits. What are the U.S. tax consequences of owning an interest in a foreign partnership that generates profits? Well, it turns out they're exactly the same as having an interest in a U.S. partnership. You are taxed today on your allocable share of the partnership's taxable income. Right? So the partnership makes $100, and our U.S. client owns a 50% interest. He is currently taxed on his $50 share of that partnership income. So again, fairly straightforward. And notice that in both cases, the tax rules that apply are exactly the same tax rules that will apply to you and I, meaning to anyone who is doing business in the United States. You're simply taxed on this income today, and there is really no opportunity for a deferral. Deferral meaning that how can we make the money today but not pay any taxes until sometime tomorrow. The third option, and this is where all the planning takes place, the third option is to transact business in Belgium, make waffles, through a corporation, through a foreign corporation, organized outside of the United States. So now we have some planning possibilities. Why? So let's say we have this corporation that is organized in Belgium, producing waffles, selling waffles, generating a profit. Forget for a second who owns this corporation. It becomes a secondary question. Can the United States tax this Belgian corporation? This Belgian corporation does not do any business in the United States. It has no assets in the United States. It has no employees in the United States. Can the United States assert any sort of jurisdictional authority over this Belgian corporation? And if you think back to, you know, your law school days, International Shoe, National Geographic, you know, that whole line of cases, the answer should be fairly clear. The United States will have no ability to tax the earnings of a foreign corporation. The United States has zero jurisdiction over that foreign corporation. Well, if the United States cannot tax the foreign corporation, what is this entire area of the law that we're about to discuss dealing with? Well, this entire area of the law that deals with outbound taxation is dealing with not the taxation of the foreign corporation. We cannot tax it. It's not doing business in the United States. It deals with the taxation of a U.S. person who is the shareholder of such a foreign corporation. And if we are making waffles through the corporate form in the United States and the corporation generates a profit, the corporation will be subject to tax in the United States. But when will the shareholder be taxable? The shareholder will be taxable only when the corporation pays out a dividend, right? And then the shareholder is taxed on the dividend. What will happen if the corporation in the United States does not pay out its earnings, is just accumulating its earnings and profit and not paying them out to the shareholders? Therefore, there is no tax on dividends. What happens? Well, eventually, a separate tax on accumulated earnings will kick in, sort of forcing the corporation to purge its earnings and profits through a dividend. Well, with a foreign corporation, there is no ability to do so, right? Because this foreign corporation, again, is not taxable by the United States. So the foreign corporation can accumulate its earnings forever, and the United States can never tax the foreign corporation. And how can we tax the shareholder of the foreign corporation if he's not getting a dividend? So Congress in the early 60s created what is known as the subpart F of the Internal Revenue Code, subpart F, things like F for foreign. And subpart F deals with this issue. You know, what do we do when a U.S. person invests in a foreign corporation, does business through a foreign corporation, and this corporation is accumulating earnings and profits, you know, where the purpose of setting up this foreign corporation maybe is not to simply transact business, but to gain the benefit of the tax deferral that you can get through this structure, you know, through the structure of a foreign corporation that is not currently paying out its dividend. So Subpart F is designed very cleverly. First of all, it is incredibly complex and it's incredibly detailed because there is a lot of room for abuse. You know, it's so easy for Americans to get there, to generate profits overseas. It's difficult, to generate profits overseas in a manner which makes it difficult for the Internal Revenue Service to then audit the operations of this foreign company. In the United States, when the Internal Revenue Service audits a taxpayer, they can subpoena books and records, they can subpoena information from third parties, they can look at 1099s and W-2s, banking transactions, all kinds of stuff like that. Overseas, well, again, there is no jurisdiction. So it's very, very difficult for the service to conduct an audit. So a lot of room for abuse, and the rules necessarily have to be very complex to deal with this potential abuse. Yeah, but Subpart F is really designed, I think, cleverly because it is intended to target only those offshore structures that are designed primarily for tax avoidance. Meaning that if you have an offshore structure, you set up a foreign corporation, you have some U.S. investors in this foreign corporation, but you can establish that the reason this corporation was set up is for a legitimate business purpose, like, hey, we set up a corporation in Belgium because we're making waffles in Belgium and selling them in Belgium. That's the reason we set that up. That's the reason for the structure. That's not tax avoidance. There's a valid business purpose there. And if that is the case, Subpart F is not designed to apply. And if Subpart F is not designed to apply, what happens? Well, what happens is a fantastic tax result. The earnings and profits that the Belgian corporation generates will not be taxed in the United States until they're actually distributed to the U.S. shareholder in the form of a dividend. But if the Belgian corporation chooses to accumulate its earnings and profits and not to currently distribute them, taxation, the U.S. taxation of those earnings and profits, is deferred indefinitely. That is the tax planning we're talking about, the deferral of the earnings and profits of a foreign corporation, right? And all of the income tax planning that goes into outbound taxation, into subpart F type planning, it's all about how can we qualify for this deferral? How can we qualify? Bob, maybe you can put your phone on mute. How can we qualify that our activity in the foreign country is actually a business? But that's the reason we set up this corporation overseas and not purely for tax avoidance. So what Subpart F will look at are a number of things. Subpart F will look at, well, what is your business overseas? Is this a business of manufacturing some sort of a widget? Is this a business of selling a product? Is this a business of providing a service? Once we figure that out, we start looking at, well, where do you actually do those, perform those activities? Are we selling waffles in Belgium, in the country where we set up the foreign corporation? Well, if that's the case, then it makes sense from a business standpoint why the corporation was set up in Belgium. But let's say that we set up this foreign corporation that will sell waffles, not in Belgium. Let's say we set it up in the Cayman Islands, a fairly well-known tax haven. Cayman Islands is not going to tax you on your income that you generate outside of the Cayman Islands. So you set up a corporation in the Cayman Islands. It makes a profit manufacturing and selling waffles, but the manufacturing and sale part are maybe taking place outside of the Cayman Islands. So now you think to yourself, well, what is the business behind setting up the corporation in the Cayman Islands. Nothing is happening in the Cayman Islands. We're not manufacturing anything there. We're not selling anything within the Cayman Islands. We're not providing any sort of a service. So in a situation like that, subpart F may apply. And if subpart F applies, the tax consequences change. So what are the tax consequences now? Well, if subpart F applies, then whatever profits this foreign corporation in the Cayman Islands generates, our client in the United States, who is the shareholder of this corporation, he may be subject to tax in the United States today on his share of the earnings and profits of the Cayman Islands Corporation. Right, so the Cayman Islands Corporation generated the same $100 of profit from selling waffles in Belgium, and we've determined that this is taxable under subpart F. This is what's known as subpart F income. We have a client who's a 50% shareholder, right? Well, he may be taxable on the $50 of income that's his share of the 100, even though no cash was distributed to him. It's as if the foreign corporation becomes a flow-through entity, a pass-through entity, right? Like an S corporation kind of, or a partnership, where the income sort of for tax purposes flows through and is taxable today to the owners of that foreign entity who are in the United States. Now, there are an infinite number of rules that apply when we are determining whether this income is taxable to our client in the United States. So we look at things like what percentage of stock in this corporation does our client own? And we find out that our client is subject to these rules of subpart F only if he owns 10% or more of the foreign corporation. And if he owns less than 10%, he is not what is technically known as a U.S. shareholder. Subpart F does not apply to him. He gets the benefit of the deferral. And then we look at what percentage of the foreign corporation do all of these 10% shareholders own. Right, so we're only counting those shareholders who own 10% or more. How much do they own in the aggregate? And they must, in the aggregate, own more than 50% of the foreign corporation in order for these rules of subpart F to apply. So in my earlier example where we have a Belgian partner, if our client owns 50% and we have a Belgian partner who owns 50% of, let's say, this Cayman Islands Corporation, what is the result? Well, our client is a U.S. shareholder, right? The defined term, because he owns a greater than 10% interest, or 10% or more, of the foreign corporation. He owns 50%. He is a U.S. shareholder. So now we look at what percentage of the foreign corporation is owned by these so-called U.S. shareholders. And we find out that U.S. shareholders own 50%, not more than 50. And you have to have more than 50%. Because what the code, what the tax code looks for is the fact that the foreign corporation is controlled from within the United States. And if you only own 50%, there is no deemed control. You must have more than 50% to control. Why is control important here? Control is important because in order for the structure to be potentially tax abusive, the U.S. shareholders must be in control of the corporation. They must be the ones structuring this, right, for tax minimization. If our U.S. client only owns, let's say, 5%, and the other 95% is owned by either a multitude of other shareholders or primarily by non-U.S. persons, well, then the thinking is that our client did not have enough pull within this corporation. He didn't have enough control over it to structure it for a tax avoidance purpose. Therefore, how it is structured must be for a business purpose. And these rules are not designed to apply. So when we are engaging in planning for these so-called outbound transactions, it's all about how can we get our client the benefit of the tax deferral. You know, the worst that can happen is that he will be currently taxed on his income overseas, just like he would be taxed on his income in the United States. But maybe we can qualify for these rules under subpart F and not have this income taxable today. Maybe it will be taxed in 10 years when he takes out a dividend. or when this foreign corporation invests some of its earnings and profits within the United States. Right? But so how can we qualify for the deferral? Can we find that foreign partner who will own at least the 50% of the business? Then we do not have what's called a controlled foreign corporation. What type of income will this foreign corporation generate? And is it transacting any business in the Cayman Islands or wherever it is incorporated? Does it manufacture something, provide a service, sell a good? Right? And there's a lot of rules that apply to each of these definitions. You know, what does it mean to manufacture? Lots of tests, lots of court cases on what it means to manufacture. For example, if the Cayman Islands Corporation purchases a chair and then paints it and sells the chair, has it changed the product sufficiently to qualify as, you know, it's manufacturing something in the Cayman Islands? Probably not. It hasn't really changed the character of the product. But if, for example, if the Cayman Islands Corporation buys fish and makes it into canned fish, well, it has sufficiently changed the nature of the product so that now it's actually manufacturing within the Cayman Islands. Again, these rules are not designed to apply. Okay, so that's sort of the very basic, very gist of outbound taxation. And as you can imagine, given how complex the subject is, you know, this part of the presentation can literally go on for days. There's just so much to it. So basically, you know, what you need to do is sort of issue spot. Is your client engaging in business overseas? What percentage of the foreign company does he own? Where is this company organized? What sort of business will it be engaging in the country where it's organized? And that, you know, slowly sort of tells us what is the tax consequence for U.S. purposes of owning an interest in a foreign company, whether it's a wholly owned company by you or you're just one of many investors. So now let's switch gears and talk a little bit about inbound taxation. And inbound taxation is how does the United States tax a foreign investor? And by foreign investor, we mean someone who is not otherwise subject to tax in the United States, someone who is not a U.S. citizen, someone who does not have a green card, right, who is not a permanent resident of the United States, and someone who is not present in the United States on an annual basis long enough to be deemed a U.S. taxpayer. So, you know, the first two are kind of easy. If you're a U.S. citizen, you're a U.S. citizen. Then you're a U.S. taxpayer, you're taxing worldwide income, you know, end of inquiry. If you have a U.S. green card, then you are a permanent resident. You're a U.S. taxpayer, you're taxed by the United States on your worldwide income, end of inquiry. But what if you are, let's say, Taiwanese, and you come and visit your kids who live in the United States, and you spend the summers here? Are you spending enough time here in the United States to qualify as a U.S. taxpayer under what is known as the substantial presence test? And the substantial presence test simply looks at how many days during the year are you present in the United States, right? And there is a formula that is used that looks at how many days were you in the U.S. last year, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. And if on average you're in the United States for 183 days or more, you become a U.S. taxpayer. So what a lot of foreign investors have to do, even those who may have like a visa for entry into the United States, like an H-1B visa or a tourist visa, a lot of them will actually count. You know, when did I arrive in the United States? When did I leave? And then I came back and I left again, right? And you add it up so that you do not, under this test, get to the requisite number of days to become a U.S. taxpayer. And remember why it's bad to become a U.S. taxpayer for these people. As soon as you are deemed a U.S. taxpayer, you are taxed on your worldwide income by the United States. Not only on your income within the United States, your income in Taiwan is now taxable. Your income in Russia is now taxable. Right? Anywhere in the world, your income is now taxable by the United States government. It's a very draconian tax regime that we have there. So if you are a foreign taxpayer and you are careful, you know, you're not a U.S. citizen, you don't have a green card, and you're not in the United States for an average of 183 days a year, what are your U.S. tax consequences? Well, now it depends on the type of income that you're generating in the United States. If you launch a business in the United States, like in your name, you know, you launch a business. If you're doing business in the United States will tax your business under the same rules that it taxes all other taxpayers, meaning the standard tax rules that apply to you and I will apply to this foreigner who is doing business in the United States. What if you're not doing business in the United States? What if you decide that you're going to form a U.S. corporation that will operate a business in the United States? So then it's the corporation that's operating the business and not you personally. So your only connection to the United States is the ownership of stock, right, the shares of stock. And what is your economic reward for the ownership of stock? Well, occasionally you get paid a dividend. Well, the United States will apply what's known as a withholding tax to the payment of the dividend. And the withholding tax is 30%. And what it means by withholding tax is that 30% is the tax that is imposed on the dividend paid to a foreigner. And it's a withholding tax, meaning that the tax is paid at the time that the dividend is paid, meaning whoever is paying the dividend to the foreign taxpayer must withhold 30% of that dividend and give 70% to the foreign taxpayer and give 30% to the U.S. government, to the U.S. Treasury. It's a withholding tax, and it must be paid within 30 days. So if our Taiwanese client has a U.S. corporation and he decides to take $100 out of that corporation and sends the money to Taiwan, his foreign corporation must actually only send him $70 and send $30 to the U.S. government. Because remember, it's all about the U.S. government's ability to tax the money while it's still in the United States when we have jurisdiction over the money and the practical ability to reach that money. And if the U.S. corporation does not withhold and pay the 30% tax, it becomes liable for that tax. Liable for the tax and penalties and interest, right? And the U.S. government can then come and collect this money from the U.S. corporation, from whoever is paying that dividend. If you're a foreigner and you buy shares of Microsoft, and Microsoft pays you dividend and does not withhold this 30% tax, Microsoft is liable to the Internal Revenue Service, to the U.S. Treasury, for that 30% tax. Okay? So that's why a lot of times when we engage in business transactions in the United States, we have to sign certificates that we are not foreigners. When we sell real estate, when we engage in certain other transactions, right, we have to sign certificates that we are not foreigners, so that whoever is going to pay us money will know with some certainty that they do not have to withhold. So this withholding applies to payments of dividends, interest, rents, royalties, salaries, commissions, I mean, all kinds of income that a foreigner can generate in the United States is subject to this 30% withholding tax. There are some exceptions. You know, there are some exceptions, like interest you generate on a bank account in the United States is not taxable. Big exception for foreigners for capital gains. If you're a foreigner and you generate a capital gain in the United States from sale of a capital asset that is not real estate, the capital gain is not subject to tax in the United States. For real estate, there is a special set of rules known as FRPTA. Right? And FRPTA deals with what happens on the sale of the real estate by the foreigner. Again, there is this concern that unless we tax the sale at the moment of the sale, we'll never be able to collect the tax, because once the money goes overseas, it's gone, right? Poof, it's gone. So FRPTA provides, and FRPTA stands for Foreign Investment in Real Property Tax Act. FRPTA stands for the proposition that when a foreigner sells real estate in the United States, whoever is going to pay the foreigner to buy that real estate must withhold the 10% tax. And it's 10% not off of the profit, it's 10% of the gross sale price. And so if you're a foreigner and you sell, a condo in Los Angeles for $1 million, the buyer is giving you $900,000 and sending $100,000 to the U.S. Treasury. But this is not a withholding tax, 10%. This is a withholding amount, meaning that the foreigner next year can file a tax return in the United States, compute their, compute their gains on the sale and so forth, and then apply the 10% as a credit against the taxes that are due. So it sort of prevents foreigners, again, from walking away with all of their profits and all of their monies. And if they want to, and if they do qualify for a refund, they can file a tax return and claim a refund. FERPA is another area of the law that is incredibly, incredibly complex. For example, FERPA applies not only if a foreigner owns real estate directly, but even if a foreigner owns an interest in a partnership, in an LLC, in a corporation that owns real estate or owns primarily real estate. And then the foreigner, even if the foreigner sells an interest in that corporation, the 10% withholding tax applies. FERPA is actually a very well-designed body of law and very, very, very difficult and often impossible to get out from under FERPA. And then for foreigners, kind of one final subject, and we'll open it up for questions in like 3-4 minutes. The United States applies a special set of rules of how foreigners are taxed for gift and estate tax purposes. Right? So if you are a U.S. taxpayer, you can gift $5.25 million to anyone else, and there is no transfer tax that will apply. Right? You have $5.25 million you can give away to anyone you want to before any transfer tax is applied. But if you are a foreigner, well, you don't have the benefit of this. First dollar that you give of any asset that's in the United States, well, with some narrow exceptions, most any asset that's in the United States, will be subject to the gift tax, to the 40% gift tax. If you're a foreigner and you own assets in the United States, real estate or personal property, and you die, the assets that you own in the United States are subject to the U.S. estate tax, and your estate tax exclusion amount, instead of it being $5.25 million, will be only $60,000. A very, very small amount designed to protect, just some incidentals you may have with you if you're a foreigner traveling within the United States. So we need to be very careful when we are planning for foreigners so that when they own assets, businesses, real estate, investments in the United States, that would not be subject to the estate tax on their debt. That we have a way of passing that those assets on to their kids without the U.S. transfer taxes applying. And this becomes sort of crucial for foreigners who are looking to become U.S. taxpayers. If you, let's say you are representing foreigners who are entering the United States on an EB-5 visa. Well, eventually, once they are residing in the United States long enough, they become U.S. taxpayers. Maybe a tax treaty will apply, and there are tie-break rules in the treaty for determining residence, so a foreigner will be a resident of only one country for income tax purposes and not the other. There are very, very few state tax treaties that the United States has in place. I think it's only like 30 treaties. So the odds are that your foreign client, if he dies with assets in the United States, the state tax will apply. So a lot of the planning for foreigners who are looking to either emigrate to the United States or simply live here for a long period of time is how can we structure their asset ownership, the ownership of their investments and businesses, so that we are maybe minimizing U.S. income taxes, and that's possible with some structures, and that we are minimizing or completely eliminating the U.S. estate tax. Well, that is really all I want to say for this presentation. Again, this is an incredibly, incredibly complex subject, and we can easily spend days on this. You would really hate me then, so we're not going to do that. You have materials that go into these subjects in a lot more details. And then if you have questions that have not been addressed in this presentation or, something that was not really clear to you, You are welcome to email either Bob or myself. You have our email addresses in the materials, and just very quickly I'll give them to you again. You're welcome to email us questions. We will always respond to your questions. So Bob's email address is rkluger@ksilaw.com, and my email address is jstein@ksilaw.com. But again, the email addresses are in the materials. So having said that, we are happy to entertain your questions, Patrick.
And thank you, Mr. Stein, for those remarks. And we would like to now begin the interactive question and answer session. And as a reminder, if you do have a question over the phone, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. And our first question comes from Jane California, who asks the following. My client is concerned with having a sizable amount of assets in a foreign jurisdiction. How can we satisfy the test for control of a foreign corporation while keeping the assets in the U.S.?
Well, so if your client is the sole owner of the corporation, that is a controlled foreign corporation. Now, you cannot get around that test if the only shareholder of the foreign corporation is a U.S. person. So now the analysis moves past the controlled foreign corporation to determining whether the corporation is generating subpart F income. And it sounds like in your question that may be a moot point because if the foreign corporation has assets in the United States, most of the time the U.S. will be able to tax the earnings of that foreign corporation, you know, because it's U.S. source income.
Thank you. And our next question is as follows. Which arbitration rules apply to subpart F?
Well, I'm not sure how to answer that question. Arbitration rules are for private contracts, right, for joint venture agreements, for M&A deals, for any contract that our clients may enter into. Subpart F is a provision in the or section of the Internal Revenue Code. You don't arbitrate with the IRS, you're simply subject to their rules.
Thank you. And our next question for the panel comes from Tori in Texas, who asks the following. Does it ever make sense to look for a foreign jurisdiction to conduct business with a high tax rate in order to increase the foreign tax credit in the U.S.?
No.
Bob?
Does it ever make sense to intentionally do business in a foreign country that has a high tax rate just so that you get a big foreign tax credit? I think the answer to that is no, because if that foreign jurisdiction imposes a rate of tax higher than the rate of tax that the United States has, then you'll get 100% foreign tax credit in the U.S. for the tax that you paid to the foreign country, but the result will be that you'll only pay tax in one country, but you'll wind up paying that tax at the foreign country's higher rate. So no, it's not a good tax strategy at all. Nobody goes looking for high tax jurisdictions just to generate tax credits.
I would agree with Bob.
Thank you. And I'm actually going to read the previous question. I believe I just read it wrong. It's which attribution rules apply for subpart F?
Oh. Big difference.
Bob, would you like to take it?
Which attribution rules apply to subpart F? Well, they are very, very complex. If you are familiar with the Internal Revenue Code, the general attribution rules that are in Section 318 of the code will apply. For those of you who are not all that familiar familiar with these attribution rules, I'll give you an example. Let us assume that you have a U.S. taxpayer that has 9% of the stock of a foreign company, and that taxpayer's spouse owns 9%. The shareholdings of each spouse is attributed to the other, so that each will be deemed to own 18%. Without those attribution rules, both of them would not be deemed to be U.S. shareholders for purposes of determining if this is a sole, a controlled foreign corporation. Now they are both deemed to be U.S. shareholders. And those attribution rules might be the difference between this foreign entity being a CFC or not. And we have attribution rules not just from one spouse to another, but from parents to children, children to parents, trusts to their beneficiaries, partners to their partnerships, and reverse. These attribution rules are insanely complex and are generally not favorable to you if you're trying to determine whether you have a CFC or not. Patrick?
Thank you. Thank you. Next question comes from Richard in California, who asks the following. My U.S. client is in the midst of firming up a purchase contract with a Brazilian manufacturing company. I'm looking for the panel's thoughts on including an arbitration clause, and if it is included in the contract, how specific should it be concerning the place of the arbitration, and what other specifics do you think the agreement should contain?
That's a good question. I would recommend that the agreement be as broad and as inclusive as any arbitration clause you would include with a domestic transaction. It should name the actual arbitrator, you know, whichever you decide on, the International Center for Dispute Resolution in Geneva, Switzerland, or wherever, and specify that the decision of that arbitrator will be binding upon both parties and can become a judgment against both parties in both jurisdictions. What you don't want, obviously, is if your client is going to enter into a transaction in Brazil, is that the only forum that can adjudicate this is the local courts of Brazil.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Roy in Illinois, who asks the following. Does the citizenship of a joint business venture partner affect the U.S. taxation of a foreign business venture?
It does. The way it would affect it primarily would be through the application of a tax treaty. Right, so if you have a joint venture that's being conducted in Iceland, to use Bob's earlier example, there is a tax treaty in place. But if your joint venture is in Senegal, then there is no tax treaty in place, right? And tax treaties are very useful for us to avoid double taxation, to avoid all types of withholding, or to minimize withholding on certain types of income, to determine the residence and so forth. So from the standpoint of a tax treaty, countries do matter.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Michelle in New York, who asks the following. I am representing a client considering an international business venture in the Caribbean. My client is concerned with an IRS audit. Is there a way to search for the number of audits of companies based on the local of incorporation?
I don't believe so.
I don't believe so. the United States is never going to permit for general distribution the identity of companies that they're auditing.
Well, and they try to, as closely as possible, to guard their audit statistics and so forth.
Okay, thank you. And one moment while we see if there's any more questions. Okay, and it looks like at this time we'd like to thank Jacob Stein and Robert Kluger for serving on the faculty of this live telephone seminar on Mastering International Business and Taxation. This podcast is copyrighted in entirety and sole use of attendees registered for this program through Rosso CLE. Thank you for using Rosso CLE, a national leader in attorney education. This concludes our seminar. We now disconnect and have a great day.